listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The UN Security Council was set to meet behind closed doors Thursday to deal with the crisis in Syria, after U.S. President Donald Trump warned that, quote, missiles will be coming, closed quote. The meeting was called by Bolivia, one of 10 non-permanent council members, to address, quote, the recent escalation of rhetoric regarding Syria and the threat of the use of unilateral action, closed quote. This was Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations on Tuesday, Ambassador Bashar al-Ja'afari, addressing the council.
Thank you, Mr. President. I will give my colleagues who are about to leave the room some of my valuable time. They are afraid that I will win them in a battle of the arguments, and they do not want to hear any opposing opinions. Those who just left the room in their statements said that today is a sad day for the non-proliferation regime. I would like to refresh their memory and say that the violation of the non-proliferation regime is their specialty, the specialty of those Western states. The United States of America used nuclear weapons in Japan. It used chemical and biological weapons in Vietnam, and enriched uranium in Iraq. France used Algerian human samples when they tested an atomic bomb in the desert of Algeria. They have actually put them in the desert against Poles, and they actually tested the first atomic French bomb. And Britain conducted all their nuclear tests in their colonies in the ocean. in the islands in the ocean. And then the ambassador of Britain says that this is a sad day. English is not my mother tongue, but I know that in Douma there is no people. There are Syrian people. There is no people of Douma. There are residents. The people is the Syrian people. I would like to quote a British author. Apart from Marx and Lenin, I would say that Shakespeare, the poet, the British poet, said one day, and I quote, "Lies defame you. Either be honest or be silent." This is back translated by the interpreter remarks. She said that Russia does not have the authority to go to Douma and establish whether chemicals have been used in Douma or not. She said that this is not the authority of our Russian friends who are actually on the ground. It's not their purview to go to Douma and to actually examine the scene. This is quite strange. Why didn't Britain say this to itself when it sent it intelligence to Khan Sheikhoun, and they gave themselves the authority to take samples from Khan Sheikhoun? This is what they claimed. They claimed this, and the French did the same. They took samples, and they took them to French and British labs without coordination with the GYM or with the FFM. This is quite a paradox. They give themselves the right that they deprive others. Anyway, Britain did sign, I think 2 weeks ago, an agreement with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia for the sale of weapons for $100 billion, which is much bigger than Al Yamama deal, to continue to kill people in Yemen and to start new wars with Syria, with Yemen, and to implicate the entire region in war that would be never-ending. This is what Britain can do. Mahatma Gandhi, he knew the British. He knew them well. He was right when he said one day, and I quote, "If there's a fight between two fishes in the ocean, you have to know that Britain started the fight between the two fishes." End of quote. The colleague from the United States said that there is only one monster that's facing the entire world today in defiance. It is the monster that financed terrorists for years in Syria. I would say this monster is the United States, Britain, and France. They sponsored terrorism in my country for 7 years. Before that, they did the same in Iraq and Afghanistan and in Libya. They sponsored terrorist organizations that are splinters of Taliban, ISIL, Al-Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda, and Jaish al-Islam, and Falak al-Rahman, and the White Helmets, which is the new invention by the British intelligence. The monster she spoke of destroys and occupies and sends its troops everywhere in the world for thousands of miles to destabilize and to threaten international peace and security. The monster is an American monster that so far refuses to destroy its chemical arsenal. The United States has refused and continues to refuse to destroy its arsenal, but they would lecture others and give sermons on the destruction of chemical weapons. Mr. President, my colleague from the French delegation said that he was horrified by the pictures he saw. But he wasn't horrified by pictures of hundreds of civilians that French airplanes killed in Minbij in 2016. 200 civilians killed, entire families killed by the warplanes of France. The ambassador from France did not see those pictures, and they were not a source of horror for him. The word double standards is an understatement in itself for those people. Mr. President, in response to the web of lies by some Western states against my country, against the backdrop of the alleged use of chemical weapons in Douma on April 7, 2018, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates in the Syrian Arab Republic today, on the 10th of March 2018, has sent an official invitation to the OPCW to dispatch a fact-finding mission to visit Douma and investigate the allegations on the alleged use of chemical weapons in Douma, and to establish the facts on these allegations. I did inform you of this yesterday in this very chamber. The Syrian Arab Republic welcomes the visit of the FFM, and it stands ready to fully cooperate and provide all forms of assistance for this mission, undertaking its functions and guarantees the safety of its members, and it will facilitate the interviewing, sampling in accordance with the terms of reference. We look forward to the FFM undertaking its work in transparency and professionalism and reliance on credible, tangible evidence. And if it actually reaches the locations, it will reach a Douma that is liberated, and they will be able to have full access to any location they wish to visit. Mr. President, the situation is quite clear. The co-sponsors of the U.S. draft resolution do not seek the truth, because simply it will condemn them and their terrorist proxies on the ground. Instead of waiting for the FFM of the OPCW and establishing whether toxic chemicals were used in Douma, instead of this, they table draft resolutions that do not enjoy consensus and do not seek the truth. It just seeks to establish mechanisms that have no objectivity and preempts the results that supports their political accusations and agenda. And they are aware that cloning the gym would not be accepted by the states that truly seek in this council to establish the truth on who uses toxic chemicals against Syrian civilians in this regard. I reaffirm that the U.S., Britain, and France did make the gym a failure, and they are the ones who thwarted its work, as they insisted on politicizing its work, and they did bring pressure to bear on its leadership, and they did stop being professional and credible, and they issued fabricated reports that accuse us based on open sources that include the white helmets, and false testimonies and fabricated evidence that finds its source in terrorist groups, most important of which Al-Nusra Front and the White Helmets, which are a British-hatched media arm of Al-Nusra Front. Mr. President, this scenario is similar to the scenario we witnessed a year ago when the United States of America launched a wanton aggression on Al-Shayrat Air Base based on weak arguments and pretexts that we have used chemical weapons in Khan Sheikhoun. These were proven false when the U.S. and its allies prevented the experts of the gym from visiting Khan Sheikhoun, and they prevented them from taking samples from the military base we just referred to. Things are crystal clear. The aggression of the U.S. and its accomplices thrives across history on lying, misleading, and hegemony, and on the rule of the powerful. It is a brutal approach that does not respect the rule of law and does not give weight to international legitimacy. My country, Syria, for 7 years and to date, is a case in point for their appetite for lies, misleading, and fallacies of the United States and Britain in this very chamber. What they did, actually, to destroy Iraq under the pretext of a big lie, which is weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And I'm compelled this time and every time to remind you of the position of the former Foreign Secretary Colin Powell when he, in this room, and I was there, and I was actually in the seat of the Deputy PR of China. Colin Powell did showcase tapes, documents, pictures and maps that we found out later that they are fabricated by the CIA to serve the agenda of invading Iraq, which was prepared in advance at the time. And the same thing happened with Libya. And you need to know a bitter truth. This world, throughout centuries, have seen different eras of occupation and hegemony, and they sought to loot the wealth of the nations or occupy land or impose geopolitical agenda. However, the political immorality reached a new low as they destroyed Libya and killed its people to cover up for a case of bribery and financial corruption that implicates the head of a member state that is permanent member state of this council that says it upholds democracy and freedom. And they have imposed on oil exporting countries to pay the bills of the continued aggression and military intervention. This is an affair between those who are corrupt and have the money and those who are mercenaries and have weapons and power. Today, some permanent members are launching an aggression on countries with sovereignty just to cover up for their domestic crises and the conflict between their political elite. Mr. President, we in Syria, after 7 years of a filthy terrorist war that was imposed upon us, we believe that the choices are clear and they are a big challenge on this Council, so that the Council would stand up against such lies and this political failure that the US, Britain and France are trying to implicate the Council in and drag it towards it. It's your decision today, and the international public opinion, your peoples and peoples of the free world will be your judge as you exercise your responsibilities towards upholding international legitimacy and the maintenance of international peace and security and protecting the world against dark terrorism that is used and exploited by these three countries to undermine the stability of states and their self-determination. I call upon you to uphold the multilateral political system and order that believes in the right of people to self-determination and rejecting political security and economic hegemony. The Syrian Arab Republic reiterates its condemnation in the strongest terms of any use of chemical weapons by any party under any circumstance and everywhere. We stand ready to cooperate with the OPCW to uncover the lies promoted by some Western parties to justify their aggression and in service of their political goals. We can see their ships in the Eastern Mediterranean, and they were waiting for the V2 to start their aggression. I would like to say to those Western parties, and they need to listen to me attentively, your threat of aggression, your maneuvers, your lies, your terrorism would never derail us as one of the founding states of this organization from exercising our right and fulfilling our duties in accordance with our national constitution and the charter to protect our sovereignty and territorial integrity and to fend off any aggression from any source. And we will not allow anyone permanent member or non-permanent member. 2, do to us what they did to Iraq and Libya. I thank you, Mr. President.
Up next, a press conference held Wednesday by Russia's Lieutenant General Viktor Poznikir, First Deputy Chief of the General Staff's Main Operational Department of the Russian Defense Ministry, speaking about the situation in Syria.
Good afternoon. The armed forces of the Russian Federation and the Syrian government have finalized a major humanitarian operation in Damascus suburb of Eastern Ghouta. During this operation, 100,000 people have been evacuated, including 20,396 militants and 38,000 of their family members. Right now, we are finalizing the evacuation of militants from the suburb of Duma. This is the final town that they are leaving. Over the past 24 hours, there have been no military provocations, no hostilities, no shelling. Overall, the Russian Reconciliation Center and the Syrian Army forces evacuated 41,000 people, including 3,000 militants and 8,000 of their family members. We continue to ensure that hostages are released. According to the latest deal, Jaish al-Islam group released 195 hostages. Starting from tomorrow, to ensure law and order and to provide assistance to the local people, the Russian military police will enter the suburb of Duma. The people of Eastern Ghouta are provided with the necessary humanitarian aid by the UN and by the Russian Reconciliation Center. As part of this mission, 3 humanitarian convoys by the UN have delivered 445 tons of basic necessities. The Russian military supplied 418 tons of food, 8,000 blankets, and more than 400,000 food packages. The Syrian government has embarked on a major effort to restore civil infrastructure in Eastern Ghouta. Overall, Eastern Ghouta seems to go back to normal. Refugees continue to come back to the settlements. About 60,000 people have come back to their homes. Russia's and Syria's success in fighting terrorism have not been received in a good way by some of the forces. There have been attempts to stage provocations, including nerve gases, to implicate the Syrian government. The Syrian government and the Russian Reconciliation Center identified those provocations beforehand, and we've informed the media and the international community in advance. On the 3rd of March, we identified a workshop where terrorists put nerve gas into artillery shells in one of the bunkers. The terrorists have not been able to stage any chemical attack against the civilian population. That's why on the 7th of April, there was allegedly the last attempt to fabricate the news that the Syrian army used gas in Eastern Ghouta. The White Helmets imitated once again an alleged attack against the people of Duma. The representatives of these pseudo-organizations have staged these provocations in several areas in Syria. They've used children, including babies, for their provocations. The international community is aware of the video footage of those rehearsals. On the 9th of April, the day after the alleged chemical attack, the town of Duma was inspected by Russian chemical biological experts and paramedics. They came to the scene and taken samples of soil and traces of a possible nerve agent, but the analysis identified that there have been no chloride chemicals used and no toxic agents. They visited the hospital that was shown by the white helmets. They've interviewed doctors and wounded people that are there, but there have been no evidence that any chemical attack took place. The militants that are leaving the Duma are not aware of any wounded or injured or victims of a chemical attack. There is only one hospital there, and Russian experts went in there, and they've been given notice that no people with signs of a chemical attack were taken to the hospital. They have not seen any bodies that were victims of a chemical attack either, and the doctors are not aware of any burial places of those alleged bodies and victims. The World Health Organization's Peter Salome said that there are 500 people who were wounded in that gas attack. We contacted the Syrian Red Cross office, who are active, taking active part in a humanitarian operation. We asked them to locate those wounded people, but they have not have any information on the location of those wounded people, of those victims. If the World Health Organization really wants to learn more about it, we invite them to Eastern Ghouta, and we're ready to provide guarantees of their safety. Back in 2015, the World Health Organization, as part of humanitarian operation in Aleppo, made multiple statements that the situation there is catastrophic, that there are no medicines. But following the liberation of Aleppo, the terrorists' depots and storages were brimful of Western-produced medical equipment and drugs supplied by the World Health Organization. Following that, the World Health Organization has not produced any statements. We believe this is a reckless statement, irresponsible statement. Such statements discredit this organization and also provoke a new confrontation. Unlike the World Health Organization, the OPCW took an official decision to send an official mission to the town of Duma to hold an objective investigation. On our behalf, we reaffirm our commitment to providing full guarantees and security to OPCW experts and provide all the necessary conditions for their inspection. Despite the attempts by evil forces to disrupt Russia's efforts U.S. to stabilize the situation in Syria, this work continues. Near the towns of Abu Dhur, 9,111 people returned to the province of Idlib. Thanks to the efforts by the Russian Reconciliation Center, the civilian infrastructure is being restored in the province of Deir ez-Zor. Since December, 37,000 people have returned to their homes. And yesterday, in the city of Deir ez-Zor, a bridge has been built and commissioned. Now, once this bridge is used, it will be possible to deliver more humanitarian aid to the western side of the Euphrates River. The Russian Reconciliation Center continues to settle the conflict and end the hostilities across the entire Syria. 2,511 settlements have joined the ceasefire deal. 234 requests were sent on the ceasefire by local military commanders. We are very much concerned over the situation in the city of Raqqa, where there is a serious threat in terms of hygiene. Instead of making threats on striking Syria, the U.S. should have turned their attention to Raqqa. We know that there's several ships that are heading towards the Syrian territory. The U.S. Navy are moving towards Syria, and they are likely to come there by early May. We'll continue to keep you updated. Thank you for your attention.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. While people in the West still question if the Cold War is back, for many in Russia it's a foregone conclusion. The confrontation between East and West has not only resumed, it's far more risky and unscrupulous than it used to be. The only question is whether mounting tensions could be managed without another major war breaking out. Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Gerhard Mangold, professor of political science at the University of Innsbruck. Professor Mangold, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you as well.
Now, your country, Austria, has been in the headlines a lot lately, given the decision of its political leadership not to yield to the UK pressure, not to send the Russian diplomats out over the Skripal case. I wonder if the question of who did it even matter. Do you think Austria would stay true to its neutrality regardless of who it believed to be behind the poisoning?
Well, actually, I need to say that Austria has shown solidarity with the United Kingdom and with the other members of the European Union when declaring the official British position that most likely a Russian perpetrator has committed the crime. But it has decided not to expel any diplomats. And this was done based on the decision not to further aggravate the tensions between the European Union and the Russian Federation, not going down anymore on a downward spiral to confrontation and a new Cold War, but to try to do something different, keep up the dialogue with the Russian Federation, despite what has happened in the United Kingdom.
Well, you said that Austria was still taking the UK side, but I heard a number of Austrian officials publicly complain about the pressure that London has submitted them to. For example, your foreign minister, Karen Knassel, was on record saying that the British were very, very persistent in expressing their displeasure. Do you think Austria may suffer because of the stance it took? The solidarity, as you said, but a very limited solidarity and not the kind of solidarity that the UK wanted it to show?
Well, first of all, Austria was not the only country not to expel Russian diplomats. Some other countries also did not do so, like Greece or Cyprus. So it's not isolated. But of course, yes, there was a lot of pressure. We had a few demarches by the British ambassador in Vienna to the Austrian foreign ministry. And of course, yes, there were some calls from Washington too to change our position, but the Austrian government has been firm, and I think it will remain firm.
I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think much of the geopolitics these days is about shaming and stigmatization. It's certainly the policy vis-a-vis Russia. There is a concerted effort, in my view, that to show this country as an inhumane, barbaric state. And there was recently an interesting article in the Foreign Policy magazine which took an aim at Austria and suggested that Austria's peacemaking, bridge-building inclinations, its historic neutrality was actually running a risk of turning this country into useful idiots for the Kremlin. That is a direct quote. I wonder if neutrality is still as valued, the Austrian neutrality in particular, is still as valued in Europe as it used to be during the Cold War.
Well, I'd say that the argument by the Austrian government that the Austrian stance is based on neutrality was not very helpful and not a very good argument, because when Austria joined the European Union back in 1995, we made changes to our constitution, which essentially says that within the European Union there is no neutrality. So the argument was not very well taken. But the essential idea behind Austria's behavior is to say, what we don't have and what we have not had for the past 4 years is any institutionalized dialogue between the European Union institutions and the Russian Federation. That was the first part of the sanctions that the West imposed on Russia. And the Austrian government is committed, particularly the Chancellor is committed, to re-establish some sort of at least informal dialogue between EU institutions and Russia. And it did not consider it helpful for that purpose to expel a Russian diplomat from Vienna.
Mm-hmm. Now, I personally came of age after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but it is my understanding that even during the Cold War, the Soviet Union was disliked, it was feared, it was recognized as an enemy. But I think it was, the situation back then still lacked the kind of hostility and hysteria towards Russia that we are witnessing today. Even enemies can treat each other with respect. And I think I would argue that this is perhaps the main difference from this current period of tensions and the Cold War as we know it from history books. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I'd agree. What is indeed missing, and what had been the case in the Cold War, during almost all the time of the Cold War, is mutual respect, and that the behavior of both sides is following rules. And actually, that's missing. We miss respect between the United States and the Russian Federation, or the European Union and Russia for that matter. Both sides don't seem very much predictable, particularly the Russian side, I have to say. And there are rules, obviously, missing of conduct, rules of conduct that had been adhered to during the Cold War. So in this respect, we are not in the Cold War as we had it, but we have a very different situation now.
I don't know, again, if you would agree with me, but I think there is a very big difference between how Russia and the West, particularly the United States, perceive a war. I think in Russia there is still a fear, a very visceral fear of a nuclear confrontation. I think Russians, that is the reason why Russians bring up the issue of nuclear deterrence so often, to show that they, you know, that they want to thwart the development of that scenario. But clearly, Americans don't perceive it as such. And what I want to ask you is, how do you think Europeans or Austrians feel about it? Do you guys still fear a nuclear winter?
Actually, I have to say, I'm teaching, as you know, at the university, and generation of generations of students, I've asked whether they still fear a nuclear war. And they don't. They are not aware of the danger. They are not aware that most certainly we will not have a nuclear war by choice, but we could have one by accident. But they are not aware of that, and I don't think that a broad majority of the populations in Western Europe or in the United States really is aware of the principal threat of a nuclear war. Unfortunately, between the United States and the Russian Federation, efforts are missing and will be missed even further in the forthcoming years to do something about the risk of nuclear war by accident by signing arms control agreements and by continuing to adhere to existing arms control agreements.
Well, it's interesting that you mention the arms control agreements, because back in the 1980s, the Soviet Union and the United States clearly disliked each other just as strongly, but they were still able to conduct those disarmament talks, and there were a number of landmark treaties signed. I know that in one of your articles you pointed out that you believe the need for that is very pressing given the expiration date for the new START treaty approaching, but do you think in this current climate, any arms control talks are even feasible?
It'll be very, very difficult. But as you state, the only arms control treaty which deals with strategic offensive nuclear weapons is about to expire by 2021. There is, based on the stipulations of the treaty, the possibility to extend the treaty for another 5 years, but it takes two governments, the two governments of the United States and Russia, to do so. And so far, the United States government has not indicated that it has any intention to do so. President Donald Trump called it a very bad deal, which is supporting the Russian side. And given these statements, but also the sentiment we see in the security cabinet and in the security administration, there's no strong will on the U.S. side to extend New START.
I was just going to say that in the meantime, both countries continue to modernize the offensive and defensive weapons. Russia has recently announced that it has developed weaponry that is capable of overriding the American missile defense system in Europe. And I know that the Kremlin intended that as an invitation for disarmament talks. I mean, President Putin plainly stated that he wants to sit down at the table with the Americans and discuss the future of strategic stability. But again, from the statements by the American officials, we can see that they perceived it as a threat, as a direct threat. If you were in Russia's place, how would you address the Americans so that they would listen, so that they would respond positively to Russia's proposals?
I think at the moment in the security cabinet, and particularly with President Trump, there's no one eager to listen. Both sides have started modernizing their nuclear arsenals. Russia has almost finished the job. The United States is almost only at the beginning of this. And for the Russian side, negotiations about arms control, about the further reduction of warheads and missiles and strategic bombers with strategic potential, the Russian willingness to negotiate about that is based on the U.S. commitment to include negotiations on ballistic missile defense. And in the political and military establishment of the United States, there's simply not a very significant actor who would, at the current stage of bilateral relations, include missile defense in arms control agreements with the Russian Federation. So the Russians have conditions. The United States are not ready to meet those conditions.
Now, just this morning, I've seen several prominent Russian foreign policy experts warn that we are in the midst of the worst crisis since the Cuban Missile Standoff. Some of them suggested that the possibility of a direct military confrontation between Russia and the West, and by the West I mean primarily the United States and to some extent the United Kingdom, is now higher than we've seen in the last 30, 40 years. Do you share those concerns, or do you think the Russians are just being paranoid?
I don't want to call them paranoid, but I simply do not agree. We are not in the situation we were in October 1962, when we really were very, very close to nuclear war, at least conventional war between the United States and the Soviet Union. We are not there. We are not there yet, and it's not very likely that that we will be there in the forthcoming years.
You're saying that we are nowhere close to that crisis. And yet, if you look at the number of big gun ships in the seas around Syria, in the Mediterranean, in the Red Sea, there is a very, very high concentration of both Russian and American Navy there. And it has been the case for quite some time, for at least several weeks or months. And we heard numerous reports of possible provocations, or this time around alleged chemical attack that may trigger the United States to hit that country with its cruise missiles or other weapons. And the Russians have already said that if that happens, they will retaliate. Do you think it's all bluff on both sides, if you believe that we are not close to anything similar to the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I don't think we are close to a deliberate military clash between United States and the Russian Federation. What we are close to, and have been for the past 2.5 years, is a clash by accident. As you say, there are so many airplanes in the small Syrian airspace. There's so much weaponry on the ground. There's so many Navy ships on the Mediterranean coast of Syria, that something could happen, but not out of choice, but by accident. So this needs to be prevented at all cost. And for that purpose, we have coordination and communication lines between the Russians and the United States. It's a different thing, however, if the United States, as it has done so in April 2017, again launches cruise missiles on Syrian sites for alleged or real chemical weapons attacks. I'm not sure, though, that the Russians would make true what they threaten the United States with, namely with a military retaliation for such a strike. I think the Russians are threatening, it's a bluff, to make the U.S. decide not to do so, because of the threat of military escalation.
Well, Professor Mangold, I certainly hope that we will not live to find that out. Anyway, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Gerhard Mangold, Professor of Political Science at the University of Innsbruck. Professor Mangold, just before the break, we were talking about how the new Cold War will be different from the previous ones. And I think one element of it is the frequency of clearly egregious attacks, usually with the use of weapons of mass destruction that both sides ascribe to one another. The chemical incident in Salisbury, a whole series of alleged sarin and chlorine attacks in Syria. I wonder if you personally see any connection there between what happened in the United Kingdom with the Skripal poisoning and what's been happening in Syria over the course of the last few years.
I think these are two very different issues. On the one hand, we have this poisoning with the British side and the European Union in solidarity with the British as well as the United States, who claim that it was a Russian nerve agent, it was produced in Russia, and it was authorized by the Russian state. What we do lack is evidence on some of these claims, and it would have been very helpful from the very start for both sides to have an independent investigation by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons with Russian and British specialists to find out and give answers to the open questions. So that's one thing. Syria is different. The U.S. policy in Syria is in disarray. We thought that after the defeat of the Islamic State, the United States would withdraw from Syria. Then we had a speech by the former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, at Stanford, where he said, no, we are here to stay, not only to prevent the reemergence of the Islamic State, but to decrease the influence of Iran in Syria and find a political solution. And now we had Donald Trump a couple of days ago say, we bring back our boys quite soon. So it's a bit difficult to understand what the United States actually wants with its troops in Syria.
Now, last time we had a similar chemical attack back in Han Shui-hun in 2017, you already referenced it, the response of the Trump administration was to send Tomahawk missiles into Syria, but it did it in a very unusual way. It warned both the Russians and the Syrians in advance, so those missiles only damaged some rusting aircraft. So in the eyes of the public, it was a tough response, but in military terms, it was really not much. And I think there are many ways of how you can interpret that. Do you think that was an example of Trump's reckless behavior or on the contrary, him being overly cautious?
Well, actually, I think the use of U.S. cruise missiles against a military side of the Syrian army was more for the U.S. domestic audience than for the Syrian government. Trump wanted to be a very courageous and tough president. Obama had set a red line. He had said, when the Syrian government is going to use chemical weapons, it will change my calculus about Syria and there will be a military response. But Obama never really responded. So Trump wanted to show, I'm not Obama, I'm tough, I'm not a softliner. And so he attacked. But it was clear from the very start, for the Russians and for the Syrians, this is a one-off attack and not the start of a new U.S. policy in Syria.
I want to come back to something you said, suggesting that President Obama didn't really respond to the Syrian government supposedly crossing that red line. I think we now see from numerous interviews and from numerous testimonies, including the latest testimony by the U.S. Defense Secretary, that the United States has never had any proof of sarin gas ever being used in Syria. So when you suggest that President Obama was somehow weak in not punishing Syria for its bad behavior, shouldn't we also interpret that as President Obama simply being prudent enough not to bomb the country until it has or he has any evidence to support that?
Well, actually, I think the situation is different. First of all, we have casualties in Syria who have suffered or died from chemical weapons. And we have had some investigations by the United Nations that clearly identified the Syrian government side for the chemical assault in August 2013. Coming back to the current situation, there is strong pressure by the Security Cabinet, by the Pentagon, and by the media on Donald Trump to do something about Syria. When Trump announced that he will withdraw from Syria, there was very, very strong criticism throughout the whole security and foreign establishment not to do so, pressing Mr. Trump to do something about the political solution for Syria, not allow Iran, Turkey and Russia to dictate what happens with the Syrian government. And probably at some stage he might give in to this pressure, but I don't think that it is his intention. What I consider more likely than another U.S. military attack on Syria is that the United States policy will be to wreck any effort by the Russians, the Turks, and the Iranians to find a political solution. So that is what I see, namely that the United States, not wanting to send thousands of troops to Syria, which they would need to resist the Iranians, let alone the Russians, what I see is that the United States is doing everything it can politically to make progress on a solution impossible.
So, what you're saying is that while being unable to contribute anything constructive and positive to this horrendous war, they will just sabotage any progress that other parties have been trying to achieve.
Well, we have to say at the same time, we have two parallel peace processes. The one is the United Nations mediated peace process in Geneva. And all the rounds of talks we had there were not successful, particularly because the opposition demanded stuff that the regime was not going to deliver. And secondly, with the Russian intervention in 2015, the Syrian government saw no need to give in to the demands of the opposition. So the Geneva talks are wrecked by the Syrian government. And the other effort to find a political solution of the troika of Russia, Iran and Turkey is wrecked now by the opposition and or parts of the Syrian military opposition. And in that they are, to a certain extent, yes, backed by Western nations. So they can't agree to have a joint solution for Syria. So what they do is to wreck each other's effort to find a political solution.
Now, the Syrian attack helped to push this Skripal off the front pages of Western papers, but I still want to ask you about it. I'm sure you know that Russia denies any involvement, and there are many people in Moscow, particularly in the Foreign Affairs Ministry, who believe that this whole Skripal controversy was intended, among other things, to thwart any possibility of rapprochement between Russia and the EU. I'm not going to ask you whether you believe in that, but do you think there are forces within the UK establishment, possibly within the American establishment, who would not want the relationship between Russia and the European Union to be normalized?
Well, certainly within the military establishment of the United Kingdom, which is now asking for a larger budget, there are forces who are interested in bad relations between the UK and Russia, between Europe and Russia, because this is what they need to get higher government spending. And I think we have the same people also in the United States who are interested in a confrontation. But at the very same time, I have to say, I do see also forces within the Russian Federation who do the same, who also stand to profit from confrontation. The Russian government or the Russian leadership is not monolithic. There are different interests involved in the Russian leadership, and there are some circles particularly related with the military-industrial complex, like the ones in the UK or those in the United States, who profit from confrontation. So actually what we need to address is that we have on both sides people who are clearly interested not to find rapprochement, not to solve problems, but to make things worse.
Now, you wrote in one of your recent articles that Russia, if Russia wants to see any improvement in mutual relations with Europe, it needs to make concessions. Do you have anything specific in mind? What kind of concessions could Russia make in order to try to build bridges into Europe again?
Well, I think for EU-Russian relations, the most pressing problem is Ukraine. Not so much Crimea, because most Western governments simply, not de jure, but de facto, accept that Crimea is part of Russia and will be so for a very long time, if not forever. But the real issue is Eastern Ukraine. Is there a chance to find a solution to those territories in the regions of Donetsk and Lugansk, which are now controlled by separatists? Here we have an agreement, the Minsk II agreement, which should help, but it doesn't work.
I'm sure you know Russia would be perfectly content with the so-called Austrian scenario, let's say neutrality or some sort of non-alignment for Ukraine. And I can even see Europe or the majority of the EU member states agreeing to some form of that. But I think you would agree with me that for the Americans, that's not good enough. They will continue pushing the prospect of Ukraine's NATO membership, if nothing else, then purely for rhetorical purposes. Where's the room for concession there? Simply accepting NATO troops on Russia's border? Is that the only concession that would be required of us?
Well, I'd say for the Russians, the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine is helpful in preventing Ukraine's Western integration, particularly into NATO. But it's not just the United States who has an interest to bring over Ukraine to the Western political and military institutions, but it's the government of Ukraine which wants to, and it's a majority of the population of Ukraine which wants to join NATO. I don't think, given the resistance by NATO members such as Germany and France, Ukraine will become an official member of NATO in the immediate future or not even in the foreseeable future. But what we see are steps taken on the ground, calling Ukraine now an aspiring country to bring Ukraine de facto closer to the alliance. And I think this is not helpful. The Russians, so the West should make a concession of not including Ukraine in NATO. But the Russians need to make concessions to the military solution of eastern Ukraine. And there we have not seen sufficient effort by the Russian side, not assuming that the Russian government has full control over the separatists, but we have not seen enough resolution on the Russian side to bring at least about a comprehensive peace plan, which would be helpful, by the way, for the Russian interests, because if we had a comprehensive armistice between the two sides, the ball would be in the court of the Ukrainians. They would need to deliver on political reform, and they won't do it.
Well, Professor Mangold, I think we also have to keep in mind that you cannot make peace with Ukraine without Ukraine. But anyway, we have to leave it there. Thank you for this conversation, which our viewers can keep going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.